From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. In the weeks since the election, we've been taking a deep look on this program at religion's influence on American politics and culture. We held a roundtable with fired-up evangelical Christians and unpacked an hour with a neuroscientist who wants to slam the door on religion. Tonight, On Point, another angle on moral values, moral choices, and religion in America now with one of the country's most celebrated theologians, Harvey Cox. But first, we turn to New York, where the United Nations is in the middle of a tumultuous day. Just this evening, it was announced that the United States ambassador to the UN, John Danforth, has abruptly resigned. This morning, a big report proposing a major overhaul of the UN was released. And today, President Bush followed up on a call from Senator Norm Coleman for Kofi Annan's resignation, with his own call for a full accounting of the controversial Oil for Food program in Iraq. Maggie Farley covers the UN for the Los Angeles Times and joins me now. Maggie, nice to hear from you. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Hi, how are you?
Well, great. What a day. Let's take these one at a time. First, John Danforth. He's only been there 5 months, and he's resigning. What's the story? What's the real story, Maggie?
Well, the story at first glance is that he's resigning out of sour grapes not being named Secretary of State. But I don't think that's the real story. He was actually offered to be considered for both Secretary of State and Attorney General, and he turned both of them down. His friends and his aides say that he's just kind of getting tired, and he's ready to go home and spend more time with his wife, Sally, and their 13 grandchildren.
So in this case, the official story is the story, but why would he have taken this position just 5 months ago? Did he overestimate his enthusiasm for the cause?
I think he wanted to see whether he liked it. He knew that he was just going to be at least serving out to the end of the term, gambling that Bush would be reelected and he would be asked back.
Mm-hmm.
And if he liked it, he would have a chance to stay on.
One can't help but wondering today, with all these other announcements, whether he sees stormy seas ahead at the U.N. Let's look at a couple of these other pieces for a moment. And first of all, this big report
there was
one
more thing.
Oh, yes,
actually.
Please.
I actually don't think it's related to the stormy seas. I think it's a feeling that he's accomplished his mission, which was to bring peace to Sudan. That was something he was doing under President Bush, and then Bush tapped him to be ambassador. So he used his purchase as ambassador here to really try to wrap up the Sudan peace talks. They've been dragging on for 3 years.
And that was very high on his agenda from the very beginning before.
I think he was very personally invested in that. And so 2 weeks ago, he piled the entire Security Council on Air Force Two and flew them to Nairobi, where there were peace talks on Sudan. And they basically forced the two leaders of the warring parties to agree to conclude their peace talks by the end of the year. They called it a Christmas present to the Sudanese people. So at the end of the year, he'll have as close as he thinks he's going to get to peace in Sudan, and it'll be the end of the term, and I think it just seemed like a natural time for him to go.
Time to go. Meanwhile, the big report out today proposing what would be, I guess, the biggest overhaul in the history of the United Nations since its creation, with some elements in it that will not be welcome with the Bush administration. Steps to be taken, once again asserting that countries can't go to war, even preemptive war on their own, asserting the place of the International Court of Justice. Do we have the UN and the United Nations, the U.S. and the United Nations, on a kind of collision course with these proposed reforms, Maggie?
There are one or two things that Washington isn't exactly going to welcome, but it doesn't prevent the possibility of doing exactly what Washington wants. I mean, it sort of reaffirms the situation that we had before the Iraq War, that there can be unilateral action, there can be preemptive action if a country can demonstrate that the threat is imminent. And in that case,
but these reforms would still...
A country can use force.
But it would still require...
But even if it's not imminent, latent, like was the case in Iraq, then it sort of bows to the right of countries to take action to prevent something happening, like terrorist groups going after weapons of mass destruction. But in that case, it says that a country should come to the Security Council for authorization. And that's what Washington probably won't like.
And didn't get before it went to Iraq.
I'm sorry?
And did not get before it went into Iraq.
Right, sort of got, but didn't get in the end. So it went without the UN's blessing and then has been upset at the UN ever since for not coming in and helping clean up the mess. And so a lot of this criticism in Washington of the UN and these attacks on Kofi Annan, even the Republicans I've been talking to say, are payback for Iraq.
Is that how they're interpreting the attacks today and yesterday from Norm Coleman and today President Bush on the Oil for Food program?
Yes, there's a lot of it that seems to be politically motivated. And there's one point that hasn't really come out. Norm Coleman was demanding more cooperation from the UN in their investigations and access to documents. And, in fact, Paul Volcker, who has all the documents and has been commissioned by the UN to do the investigation to Oil for Food, has agreed to give these documents over to Congress in January after mm-hmm. he releases his first preliminary report. So they're actually getting what they're asking for.
But they were making a lot of noise anyway. It looks like it could be a more tough time ahead between the U.S. and the U.N.
Definitely. I smell fear in the air here. People are very concerned. And it's not that people didn't realize it was coming. People have been talking about the Oil for Food program and the corruption allegations surrounding it for months. But the UN has really been behind on addressing it, and now they're paying the price.
And to see it at a moment when these big reforms are being discussed would seem to put almost the whole organization into play, maybe two very different worldviews as well. Maggie Farley, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
Maggie Farley covers the UN for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me from New York. For four decades, the eminent theologian Harvey Cox has been tracking the role and ways of religion in America. In 1965, his work prompted Time magazine to ask, "Is God dead?" He's written on the secular and sacred, on liberation theology, on Christianity encountering other faiths, and on the rise of Pentecostal spirituality in books read around the world. His class, Jesus and the Moral Life at Harvard, has drawn thousands of student seekers. This hour, On Point, a conversation with theologian Harvey Cox on moral values, moral choices, and religion in America now, from the ballot box to the dorm room. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you assess the state and place of religion in America today? Too much? Too little? Just right? Is religion the taproot of American morality or not? Who owns morality? And does it make sense to ask, what would Jesus do about stem cell research, gay marriage, teaching evolution? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Harvey Cox, professor of theology at Harvard Divinity School and author of the new book, When Jesus Came to Harvard, Making Moral Choices Today. Harvey Cox, welcome back. It's wonderful to have you. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
So there's so much we want to draw out of this book and the lessons that you took, the insights you gained in these interaction, very enthusiastic interaction from both sides, I would say, reading the book with your students, looking at moral choices after a time when that wasn't even on the agenda at Harvard. But I wish you'd step back with us first, because we feel we're at such a moment in our sense of what's going on with religion in this country. It has been so prominent in this just political season that's just gone by. You've been watching it for years. You personally laid down some big markers, put up the flare that said, things are getting very secular here, folks. I don't know where this is all headed. I wish you'd step back and just sort of plot the arc of religion since the secular city days, the Is God Dead days of the mid-60s to where we are now. Are we in the midst of a religious resurgence? What's happened over these decades?
Let me say at the outset that when that whole death of God debate arose back in the 60s, I was arguing that God was still alive.
Yes, for the 10,000th time, you remind us of this.
But maybe not contained by the churches and the religious institutions.
Mm-hmm.
God could be and was, in fact, everywhere throughout the society, in various kinds of institutions and movements, and to be found and responded to in the whole world, and not just in religious institutions,
mm-hmm.
because it looked as though, if not declining, at least religious institutions were not going to play the kind of controlling role or shaping role that they once had. Now, I think I was right about the first point. I think it is true to say that God is not just contained or controlled by religious mm-hmm. institutions. But I kind of called it wrong 40 years ago about institutional religion.
Just look around. It's
just
here.
Just look around. It's here. And it's not only here. It's happening everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
if
globally.
Look at India. Look at Japan. All around the world, there seems to be something happening, which is both good news and bad news in some ways. It is a search for values and meaning. But when it's wrongly used, it can be oppressive. But I think it's a change. Yes, it's a big change in the last 40 years.
What happened in those decades from the moment at which not only you, but many people looked around, the church pews weren't as full. There were many other centers of focus and power in American society. And many people just kind of naturally agreed with you. Yes, the church looks like it's slipping off to the side. Now it's back in center. Was that a kind of backlash? How do you think of the dynamic that's brought it back to this prominence?
Two things come to mind, Tom. One is that I think many of the models or paradigms, some people call them, for what's going on in the world back then, say that science and technology were going to really help us and maybe even save us from all of our dilemmas, simply that doesn't seem credible anymore to people. If anything, they think maybe science and technology are churning up even more problems that we have to face. So the bloom is off the rose a little bit, and that kind of scientific utopianism.
The alternative that seemed to be opening up, that yellow brick road, maybe not so clearly.
Not so clearly. And so I think people are looking around for other things, and here we have these traditions that have been around a very long time, religious traditions and others, that talk about the big questions, where we came from, what life is about, where we're headed, how you make moral choices, and exploring them. But what I learned from my students, who I don't think are that different from most other people, is that this is a very earnest exploration. But they don't want to buy the whole package. They don't want to go back exactly to what was there in granddad's or grandmom's Catholicism or Orthodoxy or Jewish Orthodoxy. They want to be selective.
And yet, Harvey Cox, in America's churches today, you know there are millions of people who are buying the whole package. In fact, that seems like one of the most vital parts of the American religious community today, the evangelical fundamentalist churches who are taking it whole and literal and proud to do so.
It's the one that gets the most publicity. But I think I'd have to say that there is a religious revival, a resurgence going on, but it's much broader than that. I mean, it isn't just the evangelical or the fundamentalist churches. The mainline churches are
I thought they were shrinking.
Growing. They're not. They're not. Just visit some of them here in Boston. Go to Trinity Church in Copley Square, or go to some of the big churches, the mainline churches.
But isn't it the case that the evangelical and fundamentalist churches with the giant congregations,
the mega churches.
On the other hand, I thought I'd seen numbers saying that I hesitate to cite the denominations here, but that a bunch of these mainline traditional denominations just overall, while some churches may be doing well, are seeing a decline.
They had been, but that's stabilized. But let me point out something very important that's happening in this remarkable vitality of American evangelicalism. It's not only growing, it's differentiating various kinds of evangelicalism. You have the more, what you might even call it, liberal or progressive evangelicalism of Sojourners Magazine and Jim Wallace.
Yes, we've had him on recently.
That whole group. You have a more ecumenically oriented evangelicalism. You have a more conservative evangelicalism. It's growing. It's vigorous, but it's differentiating and becoming more open. We have far more evangelical students who come even to Harvard Divinity School, which used to have a reputation of being a very, very liberal school. They want to be part of the mix now.
So don't think that the big megaphone seems to be on the conservative part of that that differentiation if it's going on, Harvey Cox.
Yeah. And when you talk about these mega churches, the ones with 4,000 or 5,000, it's difficult for me to think of them as evangelical churches in the classical sense. They're more market driven. These are churches where they go out and do surveys in the community about what you really like to find when you get to church, and they reconfigure or tweak the services.
And they give you just
what you want. They give you what you want.
Harvey Cox, please stand by. We're talking tonight about moral values, moral choices, and religion in America today. From the ballot box to the college campus, you can join this conversation. Is religion the taproot of American morality today or not? And who owns morality? You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about moral values, moral choices, religion in America today. My guest is Harvey Cox, professor of theology at Harvard Divinity School, author of the new book, When Jesus Came to Harvard, Making Moral Choices Today. You can join this conversation as well. What do you think? Has the higher profile of religion in recent years made America more moral? Do you remember when Harvey Cox had America asking, whether he meant it or not, is God dead? Is it secularism that's now in the hospice? And have you felt a resurgent interest in religion, in morality, in your life, your community, on your campus? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Harvey Cox, we want to wade in to the experience that brought you to write this book about young Americans, primarily Americans, expressing a new interest in engaging with religion and religious teaching in a new way around a quest for moral guidance, I guess. But before we go there, one more thing about this issue in the election recently of moral values. There's been a lot of debate in the sort of post-game analysis of that about that the poll that said that was such a big influence on people and whether it's been given too much weight. Certainly, a number of religious figures are trying to grab that perceived weight and use it for political leverage. How do you interpret what happened in this recent political season? As a theologian, did you see moral values as a front and center issue? Did you see morality as on the table, in the air, as the political cutting edge?
Well, two things, Tom. First, I read the other day that in the last three presidential elections, people have said that moral values was the main thing they voted on.
And maybe more so in earlier elections.
And probably even more so. I don't think it's a big change. I think people have been interested in what they think of as moral values. Mm-hmm. For many people, war and peace are big moral values, or poverty and things like that. So if you ask somebody about what about moral values, different things might come to mind. Now, for the religious right, they have a couple things that they want to identify, hot-button issues, gay marriage and abortion rights, mm-hmm. and some things like that. But certainly the idea of moral values covers a much wider range of things than that. I mean, go back to Jesus' teachings, if you would. He was interested in feeding the hungry. He was a peacemaker. And these certainly qualify as moral values. So I think it's a little confusing to try to base a claim for particular kinds of ideas of morals on those exit polls.
Are you uneasy as a theologian with the way moral values are being broadly defined in the American political and cultural conversation today?
I am somewhat uneasy. And here, the other thing I wanted to mention about this is that what I discovered with my students, and again, I think they're the same, very similar to people across the board, is that they're, on the one hand, very uncomfortable with moral relativism. They know that really isn't going to go anywhere. You can't say forever, well, it depends on where you're coming mm-hmm. from. Torturing children doesn't, you can't decide that on where you're coming from. You've got to have some grounding for your choices, your moral choices. On the other hand, they were equally uncomfortable with what I call moral fundamentalism. That's when I know what is right mm-hmm. and wrong mm-hmm. for me and for you, and I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to impose it on you if I can. So they're looking for something else, a way of sorting through, making moral choices that is grounded in something larger than themselves, something older and deeper than themselves, but is neither one of these two extremes. They were really looking for that.
Well, if that's what they're looking for, we really want to go on that journey with them because the other, both of the others, we can see have their really troubling aspects. You write, Harvey Cox, that when you were asked to teach this course in the 80s, it had been 75 years since there'd been a course taught at that institution with the word Jesus
right.
in the course title. It had been a long time, I don't know, in the wilderness. What brought back the interest in a course on morals that would have Jesus at the center of it?
Yeah, the last person to give a course like this was Professor George Santayana 70-some years ago. So there was a kind of a backlog of interest, you might say.
He left Harvard in 1912,
you're
right.
That's right. I don't want to take too much of the credit for the very large enrollment in this course. I mean, there was, of course, there's an interest in that. But I do think what prompted it was that we at the university began to think that we were giving students a very good education, factual education.
Mm-hmm.
They were really learning their history, their science, and so on, but not very much in how to use their education in a morally responsible way. So the faculty introduced a whole range of courses in what they called moral reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
And you were required to take one of those courses before you graduated, at least one. There were a lot of them. There were 30 or 40 courses given. And this course on Jesus that I gave was one of them.
Was there hesitation at having a course on Jesus? This isn't a religious school that you're teaching at. Jesus does stand for Christianity, one religion.
That's true, but there didn't seem to be any hesitation because however you look at Jesus, he is viewed by very large numbers of people as significant for the moral life.
Whether Christian or not.
Whether Christian or not. Now, mm-hmm. See, that's the other thing that I discovered giving this course. I had Hindus, I had Muslims, I had Buddhists, I had many, many Jewish students in the course, and I found out that Jesus really does not belong to the churches. Jesus is a significant moral figure across the board religiously. The Dalai Lama wrote a biography of Jesus about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus appears in the Quran as a very important figure. So once loosed from the specific definition of that Christianity has defined him, Jesus can be available morally and ethically across a wide range of different perspectives, including secular people.
Whether you're Mahatma Gandhi or secular, or as you say, perhaps for Jews, Jesus, you have to see him as a rabbi in his time.
As a rabbi, which he was in his
style. Anyway.
And you know, Mahatma Gandhi is a wonderful example. Mahatma Gandhi never became a Christian. And yet he said throughout his life, the Sermon on the Mount was the thing that he was building his whole life and his nonviolent campaign on. So I think one of the reasons why the course drew so many people is they knew, even though I'm a Christian and I understand Jesus in that tradition, I also understand that there are many other ways of looking at him.
So you weren't proselytizing theologian Harvey Cox in this classroom?
Not consciously.
Okay. So here we are. We've got this moral figure who stood pretty tall for a couple of thousand years now, and we've got 20th century American college students, you know, sort of coming to this issue of moral reasoning. And I wonder what kind of questions they brought. What did you find most burning? The enrollment was enormous. You had hundreds and hundreds crowding in year after year. What was it that the sort of burning questions or, I don't know, needs that they brought to the class?
You know, it's funny that after two or three years of these big enrollments, the president of the university called me up and said, "Can I take you out to lunch? Would you tell me what is going on in this course?" We had to move the course over to Sanders Theater.
The big theater.
Yeah, what is happening here? What was happening was at last these students had a place within the curriculum where they could raise issues that were really important to them. Issues about money, issues about career choice, about sexuality, issues about how they make choices about girlfriends and boyfriends.
And all this in relation
to
moral choices, to morality, specifically?
Exactly. I mean, to understand these as, in fact, moral choices. Understand them as moral choices. When you're talking about money, for example, this is one of the hottest sessions we had year after year because Jesus is always warning, be careful about this money business.
Turning over the money changer tables and off we go.
Say, you know, the rich man has a hard time getting through and all that.
The eye of the needle is narrow.
Yeah. What are you going to do about that? And I found that there weren't very many places at the university where they could talk candidly about their own feelings, fears, apprehensiveness about money, whether they had it or didn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big issue. It's a big issue in the Gospels as well. You know, Jesus talks a lot about money. He never mentions gay marriage, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
He never mentions many of these so-called hot button. But boy, he talks about money and poverty and the poor and the danger of seeking life after riches. That was one of the best discussions we had.
Did they go away saying, well, maybe I won't go to the business school after all? I'll go and work in the streets of Boston or New York.
You know, as a matter of fact, some have told me over the years that taking this course really helped, really motivated them to change their career patterns, to do something that they thought was going to help the world, improve them, make it a better place. Some went on to business school. Mm. Of course, I wasn't trying to – don't let it get out that I was trying to persuade people not to go to the Harvard Business School. I'll be in trouble.
What was your sense of the moral fluency of these young Americans as representative of young Americans across the country? Did they have the vocabulary, the thought patterns, the capacity for a sophisticated moral conversation or line of thinking?
Unfortunately, they did not.
And why not?
I just don't think they'd had very much preparation or very much training for it. And this is why I think those courses in moral reasoning were very important for them. They could talk with great fluency about art history, about political theory, about chemistry, but when they started talking about moral choices, they stammered a bit, especially when they had to talk with people who were coming from a different perspective. How do you come to a common decision about something when you have these different starting points? So, in addition to the lectures in the course, we had these small discussion groups mm-hmm. that met week after week, mm-hmm. only about a dozen students in each, with a lot of graduate students helping me with
lucky
this.
Lucky them, lucky you. Mm-hmm.
And I sat in on three or four of them every week mm-hmm. just to see what the feedback was. And that's what I learned, that they really needed some help in how to think and talk about these things. It doesn't come naturally.
And American education, society, despite the long history of religious activity here, you're saying wasn't preparing them.
It was not preparing them, and there's a reason why. Because for many people, they think that what religion is supposed to do is to give you a series of answers. You ask the question, mm-hmm. you flip open the Bible, there you have an answer. This is not what Jesus did. Look at what he did when people came to him with questions. He asked them another question. He told them a story. He told them a parable.
The rabbinical pattern.
The rabbinical pattern. He tried to enlist them into an imagination and into thinking, into a process in which they would mature as moral decision makers and not rely on answers like you put a dollar in a Coke machine and out comes the bottle.
Were the students ready to accept that? Did they embrace that? Did they want a code or did they want a way of thinking?
Frankly, at first they had a hard time accepting that. We're here because, you know, this is what...
Tell us what's right.
Yeah, tell us what's right and wrong. And when I try to say that's not how you mature as an ethical human being. You mature as an ethical human being by learning how to think, how to ground your thinking in a moral tradition, and how to work it out with other people. It's not a solo flight.
We're talking tonight with theologian Harvey Cox about moral values and moral choices and young Americans looking for the path to make those choices, the place of religion in America today. We're at 1-800-423-8255. You can join the conversation. Rich is calling from Montclair, New Jersey. Hi, Rich. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
I want to congratulate you on a great program and a great show.
Thanks so much, Rich.
When I heard you discuss this subject earlier, what I really thought about was what kind of society I want, and then I wanted an ethical and a moral one,
mm-hmm.
but completely independent of religion.
That's your dream society.
That's my dream society.
Very moral, very ethical, detached from religion.
Right, and that the morals, the guidelines and the principles of the morality and the ethics, just as you were talking about how Jesus... really tried to get you to think about your own morals and ethics by asking a question or telling a story,
yeah.
that because it would be flexible. It would change as circumstances change.
And you don't think religion
changes,
you don't think religion
environment changes.
You don't think religion does, Rich? Is that why you'd like to separate them?
I think
them?
A lot of religion doesn't. When you really, for people who take the Bible literally or near literally, or religions that have a great deal of dogma or theology mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. associated with it, particularly that's historically drawn.
Let us pick that up. That's a wonderfully rich vein, Rich. Thanks for calling with it. Harvey Cox, how about it? Can you separate these two or not?
Well, I think Rich is right that religion has frequently done a disservice to moral maturation by keeping people in a kind of infancy, by supplying answers, moral answers, when instead of enlisting people in a moral growth process and helping them to think for themselves. Maybe where we would disagree a little bit, and I'm not sure we could talk about this sometime, is that people have talked about these things for a very long time, going back to Jesus and to Socrates and to And we have something to learn by learning about that tradition and relating the choices we're making to something that was there before we came along. We're not inventing these issues, and we're not inventing moral reasoning.
So there's a pool of thinking there that's very deep and old and tested in some way. But Rich is saying, you know, let's harvest that, much as you were saying about teaching Jesus not as in a proselytizing way necessarily. Let's harvest it, but let's leave off the religious side. That flies right in the face of many Americans today who really want to embrace the faith side. I guess the first question, I'm just curious how you see it. Do you believe you can have a moral, ethical society without religion and faith, or is human nature such that it requires that kind of frame of religion to support or carry on the morality?
Well, I think theoretically it's possible to have an entire society in which there's no reference to religion and morality is completely detached. However, historically and actually and empirically, I find it very improbable.
Why?
Because most people still want to ask these big questions that religion deals with. Why am I here? Where did we come from? What are we supposed to be doing? These are not issues that can be answered scientifically.
Why are we here? Perhaps not. But what are we supposed to be doing?
That
exactly. Can't be answered rationally?
I don't think so. We could differ on this, but I used to teach a course at Harvard with Stephen Jay Gould on science and religion, and he died a couple years ago.
Yes.
A very fine scientist who said, look, science is terrific at describing what's there.
Mm-hmm.
Science is not good, and in fact is incompetent when it comes to dealing with meaning and value. That's not something we do in science. And if we try to do that, we're overstepping our boundaries, just as when religion tries to claim scientific validity, it oversteps its boundaries. This conversation has to go on between these two different enterprises.
But can't human intelligence define humane goals without religion? Couldn't it? Or it just doesn't work that way?
It could. And there are many, many people in the world, and thank heaven for them, who are not religious, who are wonderfully moral people. There it is.
Thank you for all moral people, we'll say.
Yes, yes. There are many people who are some of the great moral figures of our time. We mentioned Gandhi. Think about Martin Luther King and so on. Did ground their moral vision in some kind of a religious tradition.
Yeah.
And that's going to continue to happen as well, I think. What we need is a pluralistic approach to this.
Well, both sides now. We're talking tonight about moral values and moral choices, religion in America today, from the ballot box to the college campus. My guest is Harvey Cox, professor of theology at Harvard Divinity School, author of a list of books, As Long as Your Arm, very influential now and for decades. His latest is When Jesus Came to Harvard, making moral choices today about students in the 1980s, in the 1990s, piling into a class to talk about, to learn about, to explore morals. You can join the conversation tonight. Does it make sense to you to ask what Jesus would do about stem cell research, about gay marriage, about teaching evolution? Where do you turn for moral guidance? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight with Harvard theologian Harvey Cox about moral values, moral choices, and religion in America today. You can join the conversation. Who's defining what's moral in America today? And does religion have enough sway in contemporary thinking, or too much, or just the right amount? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Justin is calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Justin. You're on the air.
Good evening. I would just like to make a quick comment, take it off the air.
Okay.
I'm a 24-year-old male Baha'i who just graduated from a private Catholic college in Iowa. And I had a great ethics course taught by a philosophy professor who came to the conclusion that a universal morality could be reached independent of a specific religion, but did observe a universal sense of spirituality. And I think that morality does definitely have a place in society, and I do feel that people in my generation feel that as well, but I think that myself and other people are approaching it in a sense that it's a universal concept.
Before you go, let me just ask you, did you say that you follow the Baha'i faith, though you went to a Catholic school? Is that what I heard?
That is correct. I'm actually a fourth-generation Baha'i. My great-grandfather actually met Abdul Baha, who was the son of Baha'u'llah, who founded the faith, when he was traveling in New York, and they became good friends.
So from that perspective, and it's not shared by so very many people, how do you see the way religion is working in America today around morality, Justin?
Sure. From the Baha'i perspective, since the coming of a new prophet, there's been a new breath of spirituality, which is felt throughout the world. And so to see a revival of interest in religion makes perfect sense. And indeed, we saw that with in the early 1900s with the positivist the movement coming out of England in universities, and it's continued today. And I think that interest is felt by everyone, and that as we're moving forward, when we reach this global conclusion, it makes perfect sense to see us coming together, united in interest in God. And from that perspective, then we can kind of take hands and join in the common word, which I believe is the same in every religion.
All so God's children. Justin, we've got it, and thank you very much for your call. Harvey Cox, here's the question again. Can morality be universal? I mean, we see now some very deep, sharp lines drawn. Christianity, Islam, even in Europe and some parts of the U.S., Christianity, Judaism. And yet, Justin is a Baha'i. He looks forward to a time of everybody holding hands. I wonder if is that possible, or do you see these individual religions as so durable that's not going to happen? And is it moral for those lines to remain?
Well, I really appreciated Justin's call, and I think we all ought to know that even though there are not very many of them, the Baha'is really were pioneers in what we might call the current interfaith movement around the world, mm-hmm. and I think we ought to be grateful for that. A few years ago, I attended something called the Parliament of the World Religions, which was held out in Chicago, at which Hans Küng, the mm-hmm. great Roman Catholic theologian, brought together representatives from all of the major religious traditions to work on what we eventually called a global ethic. Could we agree on some common guidelines coming from all of these? And we worked for almost 2 weeks there, and we came out with something, and it was published, this was back in the late 90s, called Toward a Global Ethic.
Mm-hmm.
I think we are making some progress along that line. Now, I don't think, however, this means that the specificity of particular religious traditions in the near future, or even in the long range, is going to disappear. Just like we have German language, Chinese language, English language, we speak a specific language, that we're going to have specific religious traditions. But they don't have to be fighting each other, and they can be understanding and communicating.
But they often are. Does the specificity of those religions and the conflicts that have hung around them for centuries, does it outweigh their benefit as vessels of morality?
Yes and no. Sometimes it does. I mean, in every religious tradition at last, and I've studied them for a long time, mm-hmm. You have the more, let's call it open and ecumenical, more cooperative wing, and you have a wing that wants to circle the wagons and call everybody else a pagan or a heretic. That's been the case. This is also, alas, true of nations. Nationalism was the great curse. After all, the last century, it wasn't really religion that caused these wars.
True, true.
And yet we still belong to nations. We're trying to get along together, languages and so on. I do think in the big picture, we're moving toward a more commonwealth of religious traditions that understand and share, but it's a bumpy road.
Sure, it sure is. You can fly right out the car window. Brendan's calling from Creedmoor, North Carolina. Hi, Brendan. You're on the air.
Hey, hi, Tom. How's it going?
Just great. Thanks, Brendan.
I was really interested in that Baha'i, but that's I guess I'm going to have to research that later. But
okay.
Philosophy, now, is the Bible, that's all a philosophy of life, isn't it?
Yes.
And now that I heard earlier on an earlier program that there's been a downshift in because philosophy is not a prerequisite for a lot of major courses, you know, that you go to college for, and there's been like a shift downward.
So philosophy kind of falling off the screen while Harvey Cox's religion, moral reasoning course was filling up.
Yeah, and Jesus is a popular figure, so people are more likely to go towards that than to look at other philosophers that have been around for even before Jesus.
So here's the same question we raised. You're raising it in another way, Brendan, and thank you very much for doing it. R.B. Cox, you say that when they set out this moral reasoning requirement, your course attracted a lot of people because they may not have heard of Descartes or even know how to pronounce it, but they heard of Jesus.
That's right.
So is this kind of teaching of moral thinking in a religious context coming at the expense of philosophical consideration? Are these two in conflict for students, if nothing else?
Well, I hope not. And I think there are some philosophy courses and some people who teach philosophy at universities who deal seriously with moral issues. On the other hand, there are some people in philosophy who've reduced it to a very analytical and technical and rather boring enterprise. Mm-hmm. Nobody could be, you'd have to be enlisted to be interested. Whereas whatever else you might say about Jesus and the Bible, it's really really interesting. You can argue with it. You can really be offended by it. You can be drawn to it. But it's meaty. It's full of exciting and interesting things. And people have heard about it. Tom, you apparently read that line in the book where I asked one of the students in the course, you know, why did you select this course rather than one of the other moral reasoning courses? And he said, well, I never heard of this guy Descartes,
right.
But I did hear of Jesus, so I thought maybe I'd try this one. I think there is, but I think there's a reason why Jesus has remained the influential, significant figure. That is, he had something very, very vital and significant to contribute. And part of it was the way he went about addressing moral issues, which was to refuse to give you a pat answer, to tell a story, to enlarge your imagination, to throw a question back at you and push you along thinking for yourself.
We've just got a minute and a half left. How do you see that being reflected in American religion today? You said earlier religion can inhibit moral thinking if it spoons out teachings too simplistically. What's the best way to be expressing or pursuing religion to really come to a truly moral end?
Well, I think as far as Christian churches are concerned, they ought to go back and start doing it the way Jesus did. They all claim that's where they came from. I think in many cases, religion, I'm sorry to say, is doing a disservice by continuing to dish out answers to people. And at least the young people I was dealing with don't want to have things dished out. They want to think about it. They want to be taken seriously. They want to be engaged in the conversation so that they can work out where they're going and the choices they're making.
And having just got a half a minute here, but having watched them think these things through as you did, are you confident with that more Socratic method or rabbinical method that they'll come to firm moral understanding?
Oh, yes.
So questions are as good as commandments.
I'm completely sure that that's the way to go about it. If there's one thing I'm sure of, that's the way to go about it, and not to just keep giving them answers so that they don't have to think and struggle themselves.
Harvey Cox, it is always a wonder to talk with you, and we're always grateful for your books as you bring them out. Thanks for this one, and thanks very much for being with us tonight. Great to have you. Harvey Cox, professor of theology at Harvard Divinity School. His new book is When Jesus Came to Harvard, Making Moral Choices Today. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a new translation of the first five books of the Old Testament. This is On Point. Few books that can stir up as much passion as the Bible. When professor of Hebrew Robert Alter set out to create a new translation, he knew he was on sensitive ground. But Alter says the translations that Christians, Jews, and secularists have been relying on for years are fraught with what he calls embarrassing inaccuracies. So far, the Bible's latest translator has made it through the first five books of the Old Testament, and the result is his new offering, The Five Books of Moses. In this radio diary, Robert Alter explains why he felt compelled to make a new translation of the Bible.
Well, I was really unhappy with all the existing translations. We do have a great translation in English, of course, the King James Version, but it is not only antiquated because the language has changed in four centuries, but it is inaccurate in many ways. And although it's eloquent, the eloquence is really very much that of early 17th century England rather than the more compact and plain-spun eloquence of the Bible. And then I thought that the 20th century translations done by various ecclesiastical committees were pretty much a disaster, so I decided I would try to do my own. I think that the biblical writers, like great writers everywhere, were often daring and unconventional in their choices of words. And modern translators tend to be much more conventional and meek in their translation of words. So, for example, there's this story in Genesis 21 of the banishment of Hagar. You remember Abraham, at the instance of his wife, sends her out into the desert with her young son Ishmael, and she thinks the boy's going to die. They've run out of water, and they're in this blistering hot desert. And in all the translations that I looked at, she lays him down under a bush or sets him under a bush or places him. The most extreme choice that I ran across was the King James, which says thrusts him under a bush. However, what the Hebrew says, and it's absolutely clear from the use of this verb all over the place, is she flings him under a bush. Now, that's, you know, a very violent action. If you stop to think about it, it's a violent action because this is the woman on the edge of despair. She thinks her only son is about to die, and in a kind of violent paroxysm of grief, she flings the son down on the ground, thinking that he's as good as dead. So the choice of a particular word there leads you to see the story in a different way. I've already gotten a little bit of flack. Last week, an interview, a Reuters interview with me, was posted on the internet, and I got a lot of responses by email. And a couple of readers responded in the following vein: I am appalled at your arrogance for presuming to translate the Bible. Christ is the only guide to translating the Bible. Now, I'm not sure what that means. Maybe the person who sent the email believes that Christ directly guided the King James translators. So one does sometimes get a sense of sensitive toes out there that are being stepped on, but one has to take one's chances if you decide to translate the Bible. You have to say to anybody, even a devoutly believing reader, that, look, the Bible was written in Hebrew, and if it's important for you to understand this book, then you should want to look at somebody who has gone back to the Hebrew, weighed not only the plain meanings of each word, but for me, connotations are also important.
Robert Alter is professor of Hebrew and comparative literature at the University of California at Berkeley and the author of The Five Books of Moses, a new translation of the first five books of the Old Testament. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Lauren Madelon and Rachel Dornhelm. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.